So, would you mind introducing yourself for the audience, please?
Hi, I'm Joe Gerzak, and I am a fine artist. I have been a fine artist all my life. I started out as an illustrator, and then I moved through my career to be a fine art painter. And then, in addition to that, I have become the resident artist and brand manager for the Blick Utrecht brands. And that has been going on for 28 years now. And that's a summary of my artistic life.
That's wonderful. Well, I have to ask about how this working relationship established between Blick Utrecht, because that's an amazing achievement and well done for that. So, yeah, how did that happen?
I started in the call center with the Utrecht company before it was sold to Blick. Now we're more or less like a subsidiary. The brand is a subsidiary of the major brand of Blick. And in the beginning, I had been trained really well by a professor at School of Visual Arts when I went to school in New York on materials. The archivalness of them, the practice of them. And I thought when I was taking this class, how is this going to apply to my life? Little did I know it would become a huge part of my life. So I started to answer the questions on the in the call center and was fielding all them. The company paid a lot of attention to that because I knew a good depth of information about materials and the use of them and the problems that can occur. And so I got promoted 5 times in the company to eventually to be where I am now, the brand manager and the resident artist. So in that part of my journey, I tried to revive some of the original ideas that the founders had about educating the public in their studios or the schools about the use of the material. So I revived all that part of the program, and then they gave me funds to go out into the public. They liked what they were seeing. And I did that for about 15 years. I went to all the major art schools, universities, all the colleges all over the United States, zigzagging all over the United States, and doing these either lectures about painting and as far as the technical aspect of materials, or doing painting demonstrations, and then bringing into play the history of painting as I did the events. And I found that to be very successful in the way that it was not the company trying to sell products, but actually bringing some sort of value to the classroom. And it was highly successful. And the indication of that was I kept getting invited back, and the schedule kept getting deeper and deeper. And then I knew I had something really good as far as a an avenue to do this. And I had noticed some of the other art material companies sitting in some of my sessions and copying some of the things I did. So when you get copied, that's a good sign.
It really is. So, if I may, what's a common either question or problem the inquiry that you would have when you'd receive these calls?
Oh God, it's just an amazing amount of questions, but common questions would come up like what can I put this faster drying thing over the slower drying thing, and stuff like that, or can I mix these two acrylic lines together? And I used to make a joke, oh, if you mix these two or three acrylic lines together, something might explode. Like, no, nothing's going to happen. But, artists, there are, let's put it this way, some artists are very high level in their career, but maybe not have been trained really well in the materials part. So I would get some pretty well-known artists calling about technical problems, which I thought, wow, that person is a very established artist and they don't know this basic stuff. So every time I came across something like that, it made me feel like, wow, when I was in that class with Michael Deese, he really trained us well. You know, it's good to have a good preparation of materials, know how to use the di various different mediums and all that business. And then, so my job segued from that into working with the chemist and then developing the products. I didn't realize I had these gifts early on. That's why I tell artists it's so important to, you know, just kind of go on the ride and expand your knowledge because you never know how all this stuff is going to be applied. Well, I got I had a great mentor, Godfrey Chambers. He was a chemist, a senior chemist for Grumbacher Paint, and he had really brought me along as far as understanding the makeup of these different types of mediums and pigments and chemicals. And then I had moved along in developing stuff. We worked really good together. If you think about Leonardo da Vinci and the scientific way that things were, he was just a unique brain which had the science and the art side, the science of art, the art of science, you know, that type of thing. But here we kind of collaborated really well because I knew a lot about painting techniques and more so than the prior people that he had worked with. So I was able to actually teach this fantastic chemist things. And then he was able to show me the side of the how to get to the correct kind of viscosity or the thickness of paint, the opacity of paint, and all that business. So that was a really fantastic journey that had started. And I've worked with several chemists at this time, by this time, developing products, taking the lead on how they would be developed, the developing the specific colors and the color ranges, and just being because I was out public and I had met so many artists in so many different venues, I knew the pulse of the artists, what they were looking for, what the art supply companies weren't delivering. So maybe it was a certain brush that I developed, or a certain palette knife, or a certain color that was missing from the range. So yeah, that's just the kind of things that had come out of this journey, this very unexpected journey I was on, that I just kept going with it. And as a result, it just kept adding to my knowledge in all these different various angles, areas, because I became the voice of the artist to the corporate world. And that was a very important thing because a lot of times the executives at the company didn't fully understand what these products do. They were more like on the marketing side of stuff. So I played a pivotal role in that.
Amazing. It's just so exciting to hear about these details. So if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you a little bit more detail about this. What is it that you learnt about? I'm assuming it's oil paint with the viscosity, or is it both oil and acrylic? What was that?
When you're talking about the paint and the viscosity, you know, that is the flow of stuff and the thickness of it, the resistance of it. That's really important in knowing the different pigments and how they work with inside the chemistry of the paint. And then you're trying to figure out, is this particular color going to be more transparent, more flowing? Not have as much body in it, or a thicker type of more opaque paint that you would use to go over passages of your painting, where you want the application to be quite robust or more impasto. Naturally, these pigments live in different families of paint. So there's, organic, inorganic, there's mixed metal oxides, which are all the earth tone colors. Then you have your cadmium colors, which are kind of more on the opaque side. You have your whites. They vary in degree of temperature, warm to cooler and more opaque or less opaque. And then, you have your more staining colors. A lot of them are in the organics. So they have a much more vibrant look to them, especially even if you take white or you're tinting it, you're going to gain actually more color energy about that. So when an artist is fortunate to work on this side of the world of developing the products for the artist, that became something very special for me because I had learned all these technical aspects about how the paint performs, and then I can apply that to a painting lesson as I was doing my painting. So that became invaluable because I had been able to make the crossover both ways, both to the technical side for the chemist and both to the artist side when I was talking about the paint. And I more or less became like the bridge between the two, and I could explain it in a simple term. So that helped elevate my teaching practice as I went along, teaching artists about painting techniques and why these things occur, right? Because everybody wants to know, like, why are we being taught this way? Where did this come from? So, that all became invaluable and helped elevate my game as far as an instructor.
Wonderful. There's just up the coast from me. I'm right by the sea. Just up the coast from me, there's an abandoned copper mine. And I'd heard from local artists that you can gain natural pigments from the earth there. And I'd got, blue, yellow, and red. And there is actually blue in the ground as well as yellow, red, purple, brown, all sorts of colors. And I ground them up with a pestle and mortar, and I painted egg tempera with them. But I was told by a friend of mine, a local landscape painter, she'd said that you can just add linseed oil and you can make that into an oil paint. Is that correct?
Well, kind of, sort of. I mean, there is an oil absorption loading to each pigment, which will, it's the amount of oil that will absorb around the pigment particles, right? So that is the first step in making oil paint. But however, if you look back in the history of making paint, it was really the original pestle and mortar people behind the scenes for, say, Vermeer, or the artists working in the background as an assistant in the studio. Those artists were making paint that was more flowing. It didn't have a lot of body to it. So as the art world progressed, artists were demanding maybe more. They wanted more body, more opacity out of these pigments that they were working with. Because if you just take straight pigments and then you kind of grind them into the oil, that's fine. It's a binder. It'll eventually dry and it'll work. But the chemistry had gone beyond that then. It started getting a little bit more sophisticated. How can we improve the flow of this? Because some pigments are kind of very, they have a lot of high tension in them, and some other pigments will really flow and flow, and they just will keep kind of oiling out and be kind of on the watery side. So, in the commercial world of paint making, for the common artist who is not that scientific or that educated about the paints, what the paint companies tried to do is make this more of a homogeneous paint line. so that they all felt kind of in the same family when you worked with them. They all had about the same consistency. Well, in order to do that, you have to put additives in there. And so that's how it progressed into different journey. But if you want to be like a purist and you want to just make paint, like what you have spoken about, taking it from the ground or the earth or wherever you're getting the raw material, and then you're grinding it into the oil. You can use very natural stuff like beeswax to just give it a little bit of body and a little bit more cohesive feel to it. So these are some of the things that, you know, they learned early on, and they knew that things like beeswax were very beneficial because if you go back to the Egyptian times, a lot of that stuff was done with the beeswax. It's very, very stable with temperature fluctuation and all that business, but it was not as stable when it came to if it was really intense heat, but every other aspect of it with moisture and humidity, it was much better. And they knew that it had passed the test because if you look at artwork going way back to cave paintings, we know that, you know, some of those mixed metal oxide earth color pigments like Venetian red or burnt sienna, raw umber, those things have been around forever and they never really fade. So that's how some of those things came into the palette choice of artists using it. They knew that these things were stable and they could work with them. And then they wanted to, you know, like anything else, we learn something, we want to expand on it, right? So we want to go into different color families and all that business.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's absolutely wonderful, and I would talk to you about this for an hour, but I really want to get into your artwork because you make wonderful paintings yourself, so I should really talk about your work. So when I look at your work, it's got this amazing sense of light and this introduction of these vibrant colors, but not where they're competing with each other to create an imbalance. They're just beautifully balanced on the surface. So I really love it. It's incredible impressionist work. Is it all plein air painting, or do you do a lot of studio painting as well?
I do studio painting and plein air, and I guess I started be well, it goes way back. I was painting since my childhood. My parents brought me for private lessons at age 12. That was my birthday present. They said, "What would you like?" I said, "I would like to go to a painting class." And so they saw by that time that I was already deep into it. And so I went on that long journey into painting. So I had been painting ever since a childhood, probably did oil painting for about 40 years. And then I expanded into acrylic and gouache as well. So, but they are done in the studio. I do a lot of interior paintings, and I've been doing a lot of this studio behind me over and over again. This painting I have right back here right now is a barn that I saw in Maryland. So I did another painting from that. It worked from a sometimes in a series of paintings in, on a journey. I think I've been speaking to artists a lot about that lately, more of staying into a series and working through that series to really get more depth about your subject matter, to gain more depth about it, and to also, you know, really start to expand, you know, the idea. Yeah, I think a one-off painting is great, but I have found that this studio series paintings have really given me a lot of material to investigate, and I feel like I probably could keep doing it for years and years because when I come in here, there's no 2 days that are quite the same. The light is different outside. I have windows all around the studio, so the lighting situation changed. Everything changes. So sometimes, to answer your question, that was paying it live, or sometimes I don't have time to do that and I take reference. So I use both that way. When I go outside, I have been in all the festivals, the major festivals in the United States. Have painted in all over the country in the plein air events. I started that in 2007, but I really learned to start plein air painting in 1990. It was the first time I ever got outside to paint. So I've been on that outdoor journey for a long time. And we have workshops that I'm primarily teaching outside. Trying to teach the artists to learn to really see, learn to edit, learn to figure out what the color palette might be that way might work for them outside. All that really important foundational stuff is what we do in the workshops. And we'll be going to the Bahamas in 2 weeks. With Modern Impressionist magazine, and we'll be doing a workshop there. And I've never been to the place, so one of the first things I say to the students is, I haven't been here either. So we need to look around. We need to just observe. Sometimes you don't need to. Painting can be the practice of painting doesn't necessarily have to be the physical part either. As an artist, we're always painting by seeing. We're seeing the relationships of things, the relationships of shapes or light or just the movement of things. And I try to get them to meditate a little bit on that before they go and pick a subject. Or like I've always said, you're not going to really perform your most special art, your most intriguing art, if you're not in love with your subject. So you have to really listen to your internal heart. You're tugging at something. Yes, I have to paint this. That's a good place to be for those artists that are listening to this podcast. Artists wondering, like, how do you get that passion going about a certain subject? Well, you don't try to find it. You let it find you, and once you find it, you dive all the way in to it. So I think that has been a big thing. And I know that artists that have matured in their journey know this, but the younger artists are trying to figure out, well, what subject am I really good at painting, or this or that? Well, there is a leaning. You might be a figure painter, you might be a structural painter, like painting interiors and stuff. And I didn't, well, I kind of saw that when I was a kid in high school. I kind of saw that I was able to do that stuff, but I didn't really pay attention that that would be part of my life as an artist. But these things are become undeniable. There's a wiring in us, a certain, calling to do certain things. And that's the way I look at art, because you look at there's an amazing amount of artists out there, as you know, and you see the artists that are doing something really well are in a journey in a certain area. And I speak a lot about that series of doing stuff.
Well, there's a lot that I want to ask questions about after that. It was a wonderful answer. And well, first I'll ask it because the first thing that popped into my head was that it's my contention that there's a misconception about acrylic being a basic material for beginners. And it's my contention that's a misunderstanding and that acrylic can be quite difficult to make successful. So to give that to beginners might give them a bad taste about how to paint and what to paint. And it can be quite a difficult medium, and learning how it works and how to apply it and appreciate it can be its own separate education to what you learn with, say, watercolor or oil or gouache, as you said. So how did you find the transition from oil into acrylic? And what would your advice be for anyone who wrestles with acrylic and doesn't find it to be a very easy medium to get along with?
Really great questions. The first part of that question to answer is I moved from oil to acrylic because I ha was having problems with the petroleum distillates in the oil. After about 35 years of painting, I was having trouble. I was getting migraine headaches from that. So I really paid attention to that. And I thought, well, maybe I better explore other mediums. So I did. And I started working with acrylic. And when I was working with acrylic, it just felt like a natural click. It just natural bond to it right away. And also I didn't realize that until I worked with it, that this is for the artists out there that are wondering how you decide on different mediums. Well, I'm a very impatient painter most of the time. So I want to get things done. And the artists that are more of a, kind of in that mode, they want to apply and they want to see things develop faster. Acrylic is really, meant for that type of artist. So I started to figure out, well, I had a problem to overcome. How can I make my acrylic paintings now that I started my career look like my oil paintings? Well, that was a whole journey. It took about 3 years. I kind of pulled out of my galleries and gave myself some time to kind of make that transition and make it look kind of undistinguishable. And it was a certain amount of techniques and ways that I do things that helped me to make my acrylic paints look like my oil paintings. So then I wrote a few articles about it after that journey, and it was about how you set up the palette, ways certain brushes you might use, and and just know that you have to make decisions a little bit quicker, because I don't use a lot of mediums in acrylic, so I don't need a delayed time in it because I'm making decisions and I want to keep making more decisions and more layers. So for artists that might be of interest, you really might want to try the acrylic. And I find that you can make statements and then it kind of locks it down, and then you can put something over the top where you want to accentuate just a small portion of that. We could talk about that for a couple hours, but basically it came out of the health thing. It moved to the acrylic, and then the acrylic, I was trying to figure out if I could take that outside into a plein air event in the summertime, because everybody was saying, oh, they dry too fast and all this business. Well, it basically came down to the amount of paint people were putting out. They're not putting enough paint on the palette. You have to put out liberal amounts of, chunks of paint out on the palette to do the work, and it's fine. It lasts for hours, even in the hottest weather. So I kind of figured that out, figured out the surfaces I liked, and then I just took off with that. And I already had a feel for watercolor and gouache as a teenager. I was really not trained in those areas at all. So I found myself, hey, this feels a lot like a gouache painting. And then I know gouache is really starting to come back in a big way now. Artists are really paying attention to that. And I've been working, going back to gouache myself. I really love that because it's again, I guess the main thing for that, for the folks out there, is you have to just work a little bit smaller and use a little bit bigger brushes and push the paint a little faster. But this idea of plein air painting, going outside and seeing a scene and trying to keep up with it in an hour and a half, 2 hours max, also helps in that transition to painting with faster mediums. Now, I say all this, And I would, and this is me painting forever with oil paint. And I tried the last year. This is interesting. I like to share things in in the reality of just the working artist, because I have these conversations. I'll have them tomorrow morning with my students when they come at every Saturday morning. But I'll be talking about my transition back to oil paint without some of the things that cause problems. And I had a problem going back to oil, because now oil kind of slows you down again. And so the temperament of that against the other, it kind of changed me. And I was becoming highly frustrated. I had a lot of false starts going back to oil paint. I'm like, I was speaking with my daughter the other night and said, "This is really strange. I shouldn't even be having this discussion, telling you that I don't really, I'm having trouble using the oil paint. How could I have trouble with it?" Like, but it has a lot to deal with the mindset, the calmness. Oil paint requires a calmer, a slower approach. And that's fascinating in itself, because the different mediums require a different amount of energy, right? So that's a new thing that'll be discussed in my teaching, and you're hearing it for the first time on your podcast. But yeah, it's interesting, because now I really enjoyed this painting behind me, but it required me to just slow down. And seasons do have a way of doing that. In the winter time, when you really don't feel like being out in the blistering cold, then I can slow down and say, "You know what? I'm just going to take my time working on this painting and slow down and ease my mind." And guess what? Good things happened. The painting came around, and I felt good about it, because I normally like to finish paintings in a session. And this painting I've been working on for like three sessions, and really enjoying it, embracing it for hours at a time. But it's a totally different approach, right?
It absolutely is. And I imagine with oil, well, I imagine with every medium, do you paint fairly thick layers on your paintings as well? Is
Well,
it?
it's kind of a buildup, right? It's like, kind of like classical music, the crescendo. Like you're going through this journey, and you want to kind of build to something, right? And then when you get to that part where you really want to accent maybe the light area. I mean, this is nothing new in painting. We know that there is thicker parts and thinner parts, but a lot of artists, when they come to me, when I'm teaching, they don't realize the importance, and I say it as a mantra over and over again, they need the transparent, semi-transparent, or opaque, and then opaque passages of paint to really make a masterful painting, to really make something sing. It has to have all those different layers of paint going on to make it feel alive and more spontaneous. Everybody's after that in their work, but the one thing that they kind of miss a lot of times is they kind of treat everything evenly, and then it kind of gets boring, right? So that is something that I constantly go over with the students. You're working up towards something, and where is the area that you want to you are the conductor. Where is the area you want to drive the person to in that painting? Where do you want them to be? Where do you want them to constantly circle around and go back to? Well, some of that is the light, and some of that is the impasto, the interesting buildup of paint, right? So we see that in some of the fantastic artists, right there in England, Walter Sickert, or these artists that had these tremendous weaving of paint. And I love that idea, because it makes it feel like you're really showing the history or the journey of the painting as you go along. So you're weaving these different passages of paint together, and you're still seeing some of the initial start of that painting, the energy that was there in the very, very beginning. So I'm very in tune with that, and I'm also very in tune with the color energy. I talk about that often, and I think that's interesting because of my work on the other side, the technical side of developing paints and stuff. But color energy is very, very important in how you control that.
Well, can I ask you then to expand on color energy? Because that's not something we've really discussed on the podcast to a great extent. And it's a fascinating concept and really illuminating to what that can actually produce for communication with these images. So please, can you just elaborate on what that means?
Yeah, the color energy in the painting is really. I'm going to get this little painting over here.
Oh,
Sure.
please, yeah. I just want to take a minute to talk about the patrons for Painting Insights podcast. They are fantastic support for the podcast, the reason it's still going as well. But I also want to mention that every month we host a bonus show to our Patreon channel. And recently I was fortunate enough to spend the day out with Rob Poynton as he painted one of the landscape paintings that he made in North Wales in 2025. And I joined him on a day when it was quite stormy weather. He said it was some of the worst weather conditions he's painted in, and I managed to capture that on camera. It may sound awful, but it was quite a privilege to see how he does what he does in those conditions. If you're interested in that story, that will be exclusive to Patreon. So I highly recommend checking it out. It's the price of a cup of coffee, and it means the world to Richard and I for supporting the podcast. I really genuinely want to thank everyone for watching, liking, commenting, subscribing, but especially to the patrons. They really do prop us up and keep us going. So if you can check it out, the link will be in the description below. I always love when artists have examples that they can show on the screen. Yes.
So this is a this is I don't know how well the light is lighting it, but there's a lot of color energy going on in this painting. This was, and I can give you a still of it later on, but this painting was started in the early spring. So outside, just outside the studio window, which is right here, there was a lot of a vibration of light and a color energy of some flowers from the garden there. And you compare that to more of the lower key sections of the painting. So it's very important where you don't want to spend color energy. Well, let's back up. The definition of color energy to me is the vibration of color, and some colors vibrate a lot. Right, especially when you put a little light on them, they vibrate a lot, so they're very alive, and they attract the eye. And other parts of the painting will be very low key and have a very small amount of vibration to it. So, just in the way that we see things as we go through life, we see we come upon a scene where we see a lot of something that may draw our eye as far as a lot of vibration of color. And we're not thinking technically about this stuff, but we're looking at it and our eye is being pulled to certain areas. Well, when I started thinking about doing my paintings, I started to become aware of how that was, just like I said before, we're the conductor, how that was being orchestrated in the painting. And very aware of that. So, in mixing a range of colors, you can have some really intense colors, like we talked about a little bit earlier, about the organic colors tend to vibrate a lot. So, the way that I set up my palette is I kind of mix all my colors. I pick a one or two colors that will be in every mixture of my painting. I usually don't talk about this, but it's a very interesting concept because then you automatically get a harmony in the painting. But then there's some time after you've gotten all these mixtures and a lot of neutrals mixed into your painting. I believe a lot in the about the neutrals versus these intense color energy spots. So you can control the vibration of the painting and the areas, and you can have a specific area where you have cleaner, brighter, more vibrant color, as opposed to areas that are very calm and lay very, very quiet. And if you think about visual art is related definitely to music. So there are parts of classical music where you have this, really calming part, and then a lot of, I'm not a musician myself, but a lot of, intense music coming forward, right? So you kind of want to play that in the painting too. You want to play that up with color energy as well in certain areas. And so that's a big discussion often that I bring to life for the students, is be aware where you're placing that, how you're putting it in, and what is that complementing, what's the opposite of that going on in some other areas of the painting.
Absolutely. Well, I tried to intuit my colors for a while, and then at some point last year realized that I wanted to push past this plateau that I'd reached in my understanding of color mixing. And what I did was I'd taken a reference image from a chapel and put it on the computer and used a color dropper to find out where on the color wheel these colors actually sat for accuracy, and then I could adjust them at my own will beyond that. And I found they're all very dark, far darker than I would have mixed them, were it just be my own decision making. So I mixed all these really dark kind of mixes of grays, like a blue gray, a brown gray, a pink gray, a yellow gray, and applied them. And by the time I'd covered the canvas, it started to be too bright again. And I think I had subconsciously lightened them on the palette beyond what the reference is telling me, because I think I had a disconnect between my eyes and my brain. My brain just saying that can't be true, and my eyes saying this is quite chromatically low. And on the mix, just thinking I need to brighten this up. It has to read as light. And I had my painting, and I had it sat next to this postcard by Matthew Wood, who paints in gouache. And this was so much darker than my painting, and yet it reads as light and it reads as atmosphere. And I'm friends with Matthew Wood, so I discussed this with him on the podcast and said how I'd misunderstood the power of the accuracy that you can get by toning all of your chromatic scale down to allow certain colors to sing if we allow the light to communicate the atmosphere. So, I mean, that's not really a question as much as it is what I see from what you're saying about the color energy. And I imagine it's not only the chromatic scale but also the hue, the temperature as well, because I could see on that beautiful painting that you showed us that it has this amazing blue light coming through, and yet you can see these almost burgundy colors in the shadows which sing with the earth tones and create this just understanding of the light inside of that space where the light is hitting and communicating.
Well, that it's in everything you're saying. Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think the main thing, if you want to be some sort of, if we're just talking, there's two sides of the coin, right? There's abstraction or there's representationalism, and we could go on for hours with that. But if you just simply look at that, if you want to be in the representational side of painting, you want to do stuff like that, you'll realize after painting from life, whether inside, outside, doesn't matter, you'll realize that the darks are quite nowhere near the dark that you think they should be. It's almost a handicap to go too dark with stuff just to push the light. You have to find other ways. People can look at something and say that's a simplistic way that you got there. But what's a more sophisticated way of saying that you got there? Well, my students are talking the last week, even in here, they were saying, well, what's the difference? I mean, should we be using cool colors or warm colors in the shadow? And I said, wow, that's a great question, because everything is available and everything should be available. When I'm teaching, I'm trying to make the student realize that there's not as many boundaries. You don't need all these boundaries and all these rules. You can apply everything in every area. So that painting I just showed, it has warm and cool in the dark, warm in the shadow, warm and cool in the light. And the shadows are not overstated dark. So in order to get this believable color energy that we see in life, we're creating an illusion, right? So we have to somehow figure out, like Monet, that illusion of light and dark, and try to establish that. It could be a little bit of contrasty stuff. It could be a little bit of complementary colors. It could be a little bit of warm and cool. But all those things together, and knowing how to do put them together, is really the important part. And that you gain from painting from life. And then once you know enough for painting for life, you can make a believable painting, I would say, where a trained artist might look at your work and say, I'm not so sure if that was painted from reference or from life. And that's the place I like to live. I like to take my reference, if I am working from reference, and make it so believable that it was painted live, that the artists really say, oh, wow, I don't know how you do all these things from life. I don't do them all from life, but I know enough from that now. And I'm sure I've heard on other talks of artists, they know these things. But I, for the people on the podcast searching for answers, I like to explain those things to the beginning and intermediate artists, because a lot of times they're looking for, that reasoning behind how this thing gets there, and that, so just to give them a better understanding about, the process of creativity. If it's too limited, you start to be repetitive and you fall into the same track. So one of the ways that I get out of that is I frequently pick a totally different palette each time for my subject, and then I try to either apply some rules that I need, and then I try to get the thing to function. I think it's good to shuffle the brain and not be in a constant pattern. I learned that from Peter Max. I was in a meeting with him one time, and he said, yeah, it's good to when you start your day, to do not fall into a normal routine every time. Change it up, go into a different, walk a different way to work, or do, get dressed a different way, or do, and I found that to be very interesting, because he was a super creative person and had an amazing energy. And I said, wow, there's something to that. He's aware of the way he's conducting himself so that he doesn't fall into a pattern.
That's very interesting. I'll tell you, I'm actually currently writing a book for the podcast at the moment, and I'm on studio routines, the section. And one of the things that I say is that taking workshops can be a good way to break your routine and then discover new things. So what you've just said really speaks to that. And to be honest, I think I'll be reaching out to you to see if you would be interested in featuring in the book, because there are certain guests who my co-host Richard K. Blades and I have been discussing that we want to make sure that this book has got this wealth of knowledge. And I can tell that I could easily do two episodes with you, but at the same time, I don't want to take too much of your time. So you said that you change up your palette. So what's do you keep any colors on your palette, or do you try to replace all of them? Do you have any kind of staples where you think, I'll keep the same white, or I'll keep the same, earth tones or something?
No, not really. I mean, I don't, well, first of all, in my discussion about color in colleges, It's the first thing I talk about is white and black are color manipulators. They are not colors, so you take them out of the mix. Now, what are you doing with the rest of it, right? What are you picking? Because you need them sometimes to manipulate. You don't really need the black at all, but you definitely need the white. And if you had to pick colors, what would you pick? So this is not about, I can't answer that question the way you would like. I don't have a particular palette. I like certain colors I really like, but I could speak to that. But when I talk to students about a basic palette, I say you need a warm and cool of each primary, and then you need the white. And if you just stop there and you pursued whatever you're painting with that, you can make it work, right? So I try to bring people back to basics, especially when they're struggling, so that when you are faced with color mixing on a palette and you're not sure of the way it goes, it can be quite daunting, right? We all agree it can be quite daunting. So a way over that is to approach it where these are my options and I have to make this work for this subject. That's a better way of approaching a painting than trying to do a lot of research about your reference and see how closely you can match the color. I personally don't see any point in that. I see much more value for artists to take just an assembly of colors and try to make it work, right? Try to make it, that's what it's about anyway. And that gives you total artistic freedom, right? So, I mean, if we're going to talk about elevating artists and having the full creative breath that that's available to them, then we have to start thinking more broadly. In my painting alone, as far as with not on a slightly different subject, starting the painting, I start very different than I started 40 years ago. I start very, very abstract and figure how much delineation, how much information I need in the paint to make it survive. It's more or less like taking a table and taking one of the legs out or half of the what, how can this table still stand if you keep taking some things away from it? I rather do it that way. I find that more intriguing in the painting than to have the need to put everything in, right? So I work from abstraction to some sort of reality. And that's why I get a lot of comments about my work, is that I have a way of editing it down to the point. And I say to my students when I get tough with them, get to the point and get there sooner than later. Because if you want to keep your painting fresh, you got to get to the point sooner than later.
That's wonderful. That's really good. And it's interesting to hear that it started off more abstract, and yet you still have this appreciation of reducing the information as much as so you only have the necessary information there to communicate. That's really important. I mean, I remember Valerie Perlo once said, she said that artists have a bad habit of making the same brushstroke twice, losing the energy of the first. Which was something which I'll never forget in my painting. I think that type of insight from Impressionists is truly what is, it gives you an understanding of what we're doing out of habit. And it's just the nice feeling of the brushstroke to just do it again and again. It really doesn't accomplish much. But yeah, so you did mention your favorite colors, and it'd be remiss of me not to pick at that a little bit and say, please, what are your favorite colors?
Well, I really admired this painter, Daniel Garber, and he is an American impressionist, and he came from the Midwest and settled not too far. I'm in New Jersey, by the way, in New Jersey, U.S. for those that are watching. And right across the border in Pennsylvania is the Bucks County. And there settled a lot of pretty famous Bucks County Impressionist painters. And they were trained in Europe and came back to the States and kind of settled in this area. They were artists, writers, musicians, and so they called that area the Genius Belt. So it's a little genius belt of where all these fantastic American impressionists settled. So this fellow Garber, he was a great painter who taught in Pennsylvania at the Pennsylvania Academy of Art, and I really loved the energy, the what we talked about before, the color energy in his paintings. So how can I get the answers about what his palette was? So I asked the museum, do you have some of his paintings? What was his, where are the notes? Where are the colors? There are no notes for the color palette. And I was like so disappointed because I love the palette that he used. And I said, wow, how can I do this? Well, it took me quite some time, probably like a year and a half, but I started playing around with different arrangements of color. And then finally, I found a suitable palette that had that kind of energy in it. And so when I'm struggling as an artist outside and it's just not working, and I go to this go-to outdoor palette, and every time I love what comes out of it. It's very exciting, the work that comes out of it. So I work from a white, a lemon yellow, a raw sienna, alizarin crimson, and cobalt blue as a palette. It's a very keyed down palette, but it's a high key palette. So it will give you fabulous violets. It will give you fantastic greens. It'll give you everything you want. And the reason why the raw sienna is in there, because at times when he wants a dark, the raw sienna, and I don't even know if it's his palette, but it works like his palette. Let's just make that clear. But I'm speaking like I spoke to him, but I didn't really speak to him. But it's the raw sienna, the alizarin crimson, the cobalt blue will give you a wonderful, the dark that you need, and it won't be overstated. And then you can just get all these different avenues of mixtures from that palette. So I found that palette as a good go-to when I'm stuck, or I just don't want to overthink it. I think the most important thing I can describe to artists about freeing yourself about color mixing is simplify your palette so that you are more and put your set your palette. There's one thing I do every time. Set my palette up from left to right. I set it up from light to dark. It doesn't matter the temperature of color. I go from light to dark and I play that like I'm playing a piano. I know exactly where those things are so that when my color mixing comes and I'm really charged up to do so, capture something outside, I can fully focus on the activity of painting and not even look down at my palette and just go, and it could be free flowing. The free flowing state is the ultimate level of creativity for all of us. So we want to get to free flow state. And that is probably the most important statement I made in this whole podcast.
Free flow state. That's got to be, it's a difficult thing to force, isn't it? You have to really just find that, I suppose, a calmness and a kind of focus on the enjoyment, the
You have
process.
to simplify your thought process so that you can just connect to the creativity part.
I've heard that you have to abandon the idea of a product as well. Is that, do you agree with that? Is that when you think of making a painting, you're kind of hindering yourself, whereas when you just think of painting, you're freeing yourself to stay in the moment as opposed to trying to reach the outcome.
Yes, exactly. Well put. You have to somehow empty the mind, and you have to be. We all know that when we've done something special, We've done a particular piece of artwork where we've gotten to a state where after it was done, we weren't quite sure how we got there. And I just I maybe could end with this story. I had a years ago, we really, as a family, my wife and I, we needed money really bad. And this mural came up, a job came up. And it was to paint inside of someone's Italian villa, and it was in Princeton, New Jersey. And I went there, and it was a curved wall. It was a grotto part, and they wanted a scene of Tuscany in that part. And so I went there and looked at it, and they said, "Yeah, we travel all over on bicycles, and we love this part of Tuscany." And blah blah blah. And here's some reference. Years old thing. So I went home and did some drawings. My wife said, "How do you feel about it?" I said, "I'm very nervous about it because it's the curved wall and I've got to make this thing look right." And well, I'm a spiritual person. Spiritual is your spirituality can imply, it can play an important role in your creative journey, right? So I prayed with my wife. And then I went to the job, and the people were at home, and I was kind of nervous when they were there because I had to start this job. They left. They said, "We're leaving for the morning. We'll be back in the afternoon." Was the first time I experienced this out of many times after that, but I was in a free flow state, and I couldn't explain what happened. It was an elevated state above anything that I've ever done before. I did this painting and I had most of it completed within 3 hours. Now imagine having a grotto that was about, if you measured it with a tape measure, it curved around about 8 feet and it went up about 4.5, 5 feet. So this is all sky, the landscape and everything. I painted that in there and had no. After, well, when they came back, I came back out of the zone. And they came in and they were shocked by the visual. They said, "Oh my God, like that is unbelievable. How did you do that?" I drove home that day and I really didn't know how I was able to do that. I had most of the painting done. I probably went back for a couple touch-ups and then I went back to put a varnish on it or whatever. But that was the first time I experienced that. And you know, there's these moments in our life when we want to learn, like, what happened? How did you get there? How do I do that again? That's like an athlete, you know, doing something spectacular and trying to learn from that about his or her physical, you know, being, like how they were able to accomplish, how they were able to be at that high state of function. Well, I looked at that many, many times, and I knew that it was a correlation between something spiritual and just that point of trust, of letting go and just letting something happen. And, that really showed me a lot what is possible in creativity. And I've enjoyed that many times since that time. I've been more in contact with that. You're right, Simon, what you said. Have no expectations in the beginning. If you take all that away and you just simplify your process and you start to create, you'll find you'll get more into that state of function, of that free flow state than any other time. And you'll be pretty surprised about what turns out. Because those are the moments I've come up on many students where I say, "Oh my God, it just happened last week." I was like, "You're done." And they're like, "Yeah, but yeah, there's still like 45 minutes left in the class." Well, that doesn't mean that you have to keep painting. You're done. You reached it. And then the other students got up out of their chairs and walked over and said, "He's right. That's done. It's magic already. Now, I do that a lot of times to the students to make them aware. You're here. This is special. If you want to continue, please get your phone out, take a picture of it, because I don't know if you're going to, in my mind, I don't say anything negative, but are you going to destroy it? Are you going to take the energy out of it? That's fine. That's all lesson. But you've reached something here. This is important. And that student, I believe, was in a free flow state, right? So something happened. It came together like that, and it was just there. And the other students agreed. I don't try to embellish or, push comments when they're not needed. If they're struggling, I'm going to tell them the way it is too. It's just going to be honest, and it might be hard for them to hear, but I'm not mean, but I just tell them. But when something like that happens, I also kind of want the room to know, look at this. And they did. They looked at it, and it was there. So I think, all these things are important to having an awareness of, what you can contribute to others and what, and if other people are, maybe struggling and they're not sure knowing what that may look like for them. It's not about time. It's not about the length of time. It's not about, the hours you put in or not. No, something unbelievable, magical can happen. And it can just come to be in a short amount of time if the mind has, exited all this distraction in our life, all these things going on, and you're just in that state. So yeah, that's special.
That's fantastic. Now, please tell me you have images of the Italian villa. I really want to show that
Oh
answer.
yeah. I'm gonna try to find that for you. Yes.
Please, please. I really want to see that. And I'd love to show it whilst you're telling that story because that was magic.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, as far as, because that seems like something which only people who know those lovely people who have that piece of art of yours will have the privilege of seeing it in person. And a big thing that I like to discuss is that I know that the art market is moving on and it's becoming this online conversation with the marketplace, but there's no comparison to seeing work in person. And it really is such a privilege to be able to go and look at paintings, see them face to face, and to analyze the brush strokes, the textures, the scale. It just doesn't compare by
Right.
seeing it on a screen. Doesn't matter how big your screen is and how high definition it is, it just doesn't compare. So
Right.
how, like, where does your work exhibit publicly? Do you have galleries that show you your work regularly? And if so, where are those?
I have a gallery in Maryland, in Eastern Maryland, Troika Gallery, Fine Art, Troika Gallery, Fine Art, and I have one locally here in New Jersey, Artful Deposit. It's a small little pocket gallery. I'm in both of those galleries. That fluctuates. I've had more or less galleries. I also am posting my journey all the time on Instagram. So whatever I'm working through, or if I have a thought that I want to share, I put that on Instagram, and I have, collectors contacting me on there as well. But yeah, so, and then I'm involved with the American Impressionist Society, and I've been that a member of that for 14 years. And in December, I got a call from the American Impressionist Society. I was inducted as a master from the board of directors and the other master artists. I became a master in that society, and that was a big deal for me, a milestone. And I'm also part of the Oil Painters of America. I'm a signature member there. So I exhibit in those two realms like you guys do for the Royal Painter stuff over there. We have these venues here, and going back to the very beginning, I work on both. It's an interesting thing. I'm an artist, exhibiting artist, but I'm also a presenter a lot of times at these programs from the side of my company. So again, I've had this amazing journey where both careers have been intertwined for a long time now. And it actually helps the brand. The brand gives back to me. Yeah, it's just that kind of interesting synergy that happens.
Excellent. Well, can I say congratulations for being part of the Master Society? That's well deserved. Your work is
Thank
phenomenally
you.
beautiful. I really do admire it. It's absolutely
Thank you.
wonderful. Now, if people aren't fortunate enough to see your work in person, you mentioned your Instagram account. I'm going to be showing these on screen for the viewers and for the listeners. I always say that all of the links will be in the description. So, where aside from Instagram, is there anywhere else online that people can see your work and to support you?
Well, I have my website, josephgerzak.com, so you can see work on there. I'm not as frequent on there, but I need to update the workshops for the year as well on there. But I have workshops, and I have the workshop in Bahamas with Haiti Joe that is sold out. There was a waiting list for that. We're going at the end of January here, and then I'm also going to be at the Plein Air South, which is a very special event in Florida, and the Forgotten Coast event in March. I'll be at these two events in Florida, and then I'm judging some shows, and then I'm also going to be in New Jersey. I'll be local. I'll be doing a workshop in July on the beaches in New Jersey. We're trying to start that plein air program up locally here. I want to the Long Island Beach Foundation of Art is trying to get a program started there. So last year we had a nice little turnout, but I'm looking to grow that. I like to grow relationships with these workshops and stuff so that I can return. And then we'll be going to Italy, Umbria, in September, the 19th through the 28th. I think there's still a couple spots open there with the Modern Impressionist magazine. And then every year I do a workshop. I've been doing it for 10 years now. It's a plein air workshop in Vent Matthews, Virginia. So those are some of the other places that you may see me doing painting demonstrations, or you may see some examples of my work as I teach. Yeah, and like I said, I'll be in those two, hope to be in those two national shows. Well, I'll be in one of them because I'm a master, but the other one I have to submit and see if I get accepted.
Lovely. Well, we're recording this in January. We'll be uploading it obviously before your trip in March. So we'll make sure to leave all the links for all of those in the all of those workshops in the description. Please, everyone, check the availability. Grab a place if you can, because it'd be a wealth of knowledge. I'd love to have you on again. You're one of those artists, so I can tell that I could easily discuss all of these topics with you again and get into more detail. It's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate it as well. It was great to be here with you and your lovely host.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode. If you can support the podcast by leaving a like or a comment down below, that'd really be great. But what we'd really like is if you're able to leave a review on the podcast channels, wherever you listen to it or download it, because that helps us get spread around the internet so that more people have access to us and able to see what we're making.
Also, follow us on Instagram, and we'd really appreciate it if you like and engage with our posts. Help get the podcast better known. Thanks for listening.